Welcome back to Palisades Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Michael Guyad. He's publisher of the Lead Lag Report, portfolio manager at ATAC Rotation Fund and Toroso Investments. How are you today, Michael?
Yeah, I'm okay. Okay.
I noticed on your the Lead Lag Report website, it says that you guys try to identify risks, navigate volatility, and maximize long-term gains. So could you tell us a bit how you're looking at thinking about volatility and risk right now?
Yeah, so a few things. First of all, I don't view volatility as risk, right? So volatility is really doubt. It's not really risk in that sense. I think risk is always, as an investor, I think it's permanent loss potential, which often happens when people compound negatively at the wrong time, right? So the way that I view risk on, risk off dynamic is really more in terms of conditions that favor an accident, where you might have a quasi-permanent loss of capital, which is where the risk is. I always emphasize the word conditions when I talk about markets, whenever I analyze markets. Because even though we're in this business of forecasting, the reality is nobody knows what the S&P is going to look like by the end of the year, where interest rates are going to be, what the price of oil is going to be. The best you can really do is identify the weather, right? You don't know the exact mile marker you might crash, but you know the conditions that make it more likely to happen. So from that perspective, conditions are always changing, right? And anybody that's trying to be somewhat active needs to be aware of that weather changing day by day, week by week. Now, those conditions obviously look a little bit more concerning as we're talking here, not necessarily because the markets themselves have been breaking down at the start of the week here, but really more because you're seeing some pretty remarkable strength in utilities, which have been ongoing for the last 7-8 weeks. When I think about risk, one of the key areas of the marketplace I like to focus on is the utility sector, because utilities are one of the most bond-like sectors of the stock market, and their movement because of that tells you a lot about changes in the demand for capital. Utilities have been on fire relative to the market. That tends to happen prior to major high stress volatility periods, at least here in the States. So very short term, you know, I'd make the case that the storm may be here. Whether that means an accident occurs or not, I'll tell you long after the fact.
Yeah, it's always difficult to really put a finger on exactly what might cause that liquidity crunch, let's say. But so let's talk about some of the indicators that you watch. So something like the treasury market, what is that telling us right now?
Treasuries have sold off pretty nicely, I would argue. It looked like, you know, you might have some kind of a yield breakout in the last few weeks here. But now, I mean, that's the thing with these kind of breakouts. They could be false breakouts and yields. Typically, you want to see the yield curve steepening in a true bull market for stocks, because yield curve steepening would reflect rising growth and inflation expectations. And that's been somewhat of a sticking point, you know, as the rally has kind of taken place off of the low. And it looks like yields now may be starting to try to run higher. But if it's a false breakout, a false move, then they could come back in. That'll be also consistent with a broader risk off type of environment. Going back to utilities, typically utilities and treasuries confirm each other, meaning that when utilities are strong, treasuries tend to be strong because it's all a play on interest rates. Treasuries have not been confirming the strength in utilities yet. But as we get closer to the election, that may start to change. And I think that kind of goes back to the point that I think we're probably entering some kind of a storm here.
Excellent, Michael. So you were also saying that bonds are no longer providing the diversification benefit that they once did. So what are some of the implications of that?
Yeah, so this is, I've been kind of ranting on this for a bit here. So look, when the Fed decided to save capitalism with socialism by them buying up corporate munis and junk debt in the depths of the COVID crash, they broke the bond market, meaning that they removed the compensation for both inflation risk and for default deflation risk, because they just decided to try to manipulate and will this into a recovery. That breaks bonds, because if the idea of a 60-40 stock bond allocation is to diversify, have a lower volatility portfolio because your bonds cushion your stocks, well, now you don't have that cushion anymore because the Fed took it out, right? So there are implications from a longer-term asset allocation perspective on the idea that stocks and bonds diversify you. And I think that makes for a broader case towards alternative strategies, alternative products, things like gold, things which are not as correlated to broader equities, because you kind of don't have a choice if you're trying to protect a little bit on the downside when bonds are doing what they've done.
So, Michael, as we've seen things like the 30-year mortgage rate hit record lows for the 10th time this year, but we're also seeing lending standards being tightened. What does this mean for monetary velocity and the longer-term implications for, let's say, inflation versus deflation?
It's a very strange dynamic the Fed has put itself in, right? So they try to reflate with more debt by lowering rates further, by trying to create an incentive to borrow more, which is adds to the debt pile, which longer term is deflationary. So you try to solve the longer term issue of deflation with short term inflationary policies that just tack on more liabilities, right? And that's why you're in this, I think, this debt trap, right, which has been talked about for a number of years and seems really very plausible given the way things are now. And because there's so much debt in the system, you can't possibly grow your way out of it. You can either try to hope for inflating it away, and you can inflate it away with more money, which is what the Fed tries to keep doing. All central banks, by the way, not just the Fed. And or you try and do it with velocity of money picking up, because inflation is a function of not just money supply, but the number of transactions with that money supply. It's hard to see how the velocity of money can pick up when everything is still on demand. So there's no urgency to buy things now unless you're hoarding, which probably explains why there has been food inflation. And it's hard to sort of see a scenario where that changes because there's no urgency to borrow at low rates if everybody believes rates will be low forever. Right? The velocity of money, which is a key component of trying to actually get the inflation the Fed wants, is largely psychologically driven as well. And I think the Fed, in basically saying outright, well, we're not planning on raising rates until whatever it is, 2022 or whatever the year Powell randomly chooses, tells you that things are going to be in this kind of disinflationary longer term wave for a while.
So, Michael, when we think about the way that the government or the Fed looks at their inflation numbers, and we look at, let's say, just food sector inflation, how do you think the Fed is able to say, well, we don't have the inflation that we're looking for? Is it in a way they just have their blinders on to certain types of inflation?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, we throw out these terms, inflation, deflation, a lot. There's a lot of nuances to it, right? You have inflation in home prices, you have inflation in education, you have inflation in food. Those things that you see, you have deflation, everything else around you, right? So even that's, I feel like, a much bigger discussion sort of around how you define inflation. I think for the Fed, what they're really hoping for is wage inflation, which really only comes from bargaining power on labor because of lower capitalization utilization on the labor side, which you really don't have in a world where everyone's now working from home and you can easily hire somebody through Upwork in India as you can from Canada or the US, right? So it's hard to sort of see the right kind of inflation, which is wage inflation, happen because it's outside of the Fed's control when technology is, I think, enabling things faster than their printing presses can keep up.
So this kind of brings us to our next point here, Michael. You were talking about the last great bubble is faith in central banks. So how do you see that starting to break down?
Yeah, so I mean, I started using that term, I think, back in 2013, and that last great bubble has taken a while. It's kind of like the Greenspan said in the mid-90s, irrational exuberance. He was right, but he was like 4 or 5 years early, right? Mm-hmm. So look, the core issue here is that the Federal Reserve, I think, has enabled tremendous profligate spending on the fiscal side. Especially when you remove the gold standard as a result of that, resulted in a society, not just in the United States, but I think it's a dynamic you see everywhere, where the wealth gap keeps widening because you don't have discipline, okay? And there then become other larger term things to think through as a result of the Fed basically saying that discipline doesn't matter and that debt doesn't matter. Because if debt doesn't matter, why are we paying taxes? If debt doesn't matter, then how can you have any kind of incentive system? How can you have capitalism? If debt doesn't matter, then how can you have anybody come into the office to do the right thing and actually enforce some degree of pain on the population to actually reduce debt, right? So I don't know how it plays out longer term. I've been addressing this kind of point in writings quite a bit and on Twitter. There are all kinds of unintended consequences that happen when you have these systems go unchecked. So yeah, they can try and do liquidity to solve solvency, but that has other implications, even though companies may still be in existence because of what the Fed's doing, there are other implications on society, which I think are quite problematic.
So, Michael, as we're speaking here on the 26th of October, we're heading into the election here. So how are you guys positioning your portfolios to maybe take some risk off going into the election?
Yeah, so it goes back to sort of the conditions, right? Everything I do is quantitatively driven, so it's not really based on my opinion in the ATAC rotation fund, the mutual fund I run, which, you know, it's up about north of 50% for the year, going risk on, risk off. You know, I have to kind of follow the signals that got me to the dance, so to speak. So it seems plausible that a lot of signals are lining up here to suggest we're entering a risk off period. But remember, keep in mind, just because it's raining doesn't mean you're going to crash. Just because it's sunny doesn't mean you won't. Conditions are there. It doesn't mean you necessarily have the accident. I do think that there is a large degree of complacency, not necessarily on the elections. I think there's a large degree of complacency in risk, which nobody really is focusing on. Because oftentimes it's where people don't look at. That's where the surprises come in. That's where you end up having these high stress periods. And I've been kind of alluding to this idea that there's kind of two major risks, which I think nobody's really thinking through. One is European financials as a sector look like death. And I'm sorry to say it in that way, but the reality is these equities look horrendous. I find it hard to believe how you could have a healthy stock market globally if European financial equities are signaling something very severe is coming. And maybe it doesn't, but I think there's a risk there that nobody's talking about. The other major risk is, you know, what if the message of lumber prices is correct? So lumber went vertical coming out of the low and then completely crashed about a month or so ago. Generally, most major stock market crashes, corrections, bear markets are preceded not just by strength in utilities and treasuries, which you're starting to see, but also by weakness in lumber, because lumber is a talent housing and most U.S. consumer wealth is from their homes. If lumber is anticipating a very sudden and abrupt slowdown in housing, that's a much bigger risk than whoever is president, right, for the stock market. Mm-hmm. And that becomes problematic because mortgage rates are already at all-time historic lows. So what more can you possibly do to try and spur housing beyond this initial demand spurt as people move out of cities into more suburban areas? If we're kind of done with that phase or largely done with that phase, now what do you have left? Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, as you talk about these conditions and, you know, market indicators, you were able to kind of warn some of your subscribers before the crash in February. So what were some of the indicators that were signaling that crash was coming?
So everything for me is about the behavior of various intermarket trends. So when on Seeking Alpha on February 27th, I was making the case that we may be in a crash and here's why. It wasn't me making a call. I was just making the observation that the internals of the market were suggestive of something that you would see typically in a crash to begin with. It's funny because always people always focus on what's the call rather than what are the conditions, which I'll never quite understand. It's the single role of the die versus the multiple role of the process. So utilities are strengthening, treasuries are strengthening. Utilities are strengthening like they are now prior to that February start of the collapse. Treasury, same kind of deal. Lumber also gave you a warning sign mid-February. This has been a pretty prolonged period where lumber has been weak and you haven't seen a commensurate period of risk off in broader equities. So I do see some parallels. The only thing that kind of gives me some solace here is in psychology, there's a term, the escalation of commitment, which is to say that the Fed has made it very clear that they will do anything and everything to the point of testing the limits of legality to try and prevent the stock market from utterly cratering. And that means that if you are going to have another real risk off period, I do think the magnitude is probably going to be somewhat limited only because if the Fed needs to step in and start buying stocks, it's clear that they will. They already went the step of buying junk debt and buying up munis. So if they manipulated it already once, they'll manipulate it further. They're already committed to that. So while I am concerned about risk, I'm not as concerned about sort of a doomsday scenario because, again, you know, as we've seen, the Fed, which is very good at creatively preventing creative destruction, the last great bubble, which is faith in the Fed, at some point that will burst. But again, bubbles can last for a while.
Mm-hmm. And that really kind of reminds me of something you were saying about don't fight the Fed. You know, most people follow that blindly, but there are times when you need to really look at that and second guess that, right?
Yeah, that saying never made any sense to me. It's like, you know, you don't fight the Fed. Well, you could have fought the Fed at any point then when they lowered rates from 2000, 2002 and 2008 and 2011. This notion of don't fight the Fed is a very strange concept to me because markets go down mm-hmm. when the Fed's still acting. So what does that mean, don't fight the Fed? It means, well, basically be a buy and hold investor. Well, then why is it don't fight the Fed, but don't fight the BOJ, which has been trying to fight deflation in Japan and Japanese stock market is nowhere near its 1989 peak. Right. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of people kind of say things without thinking through the clear examples that suggest that what they're saying has no validity.
Absolutely. So, Michael, as we know, gold is not typically considered a correlated asset to the general equity market. So can we make the argument that it would be correlated, obviously, much more to real yields and not the general equities? And what is the correlation of gold to a general equities market crash?
Yeah, so a lot of people, I think, get gold wrong in the sense that gold doesn't really correlate to a lot of macroeconomic variables, but history does suggest that in the sort of 2 to 4 week period around a crash, both before and after, you tend to see gold really get attention. And the reason that gold is correlated to real yields is because the lower real yields go, which is after inflation, the more the yield of gold, which is zero, looks more attractive, right? So it's not just gold, it's kind of a broader commodities anyway. And with yields, especially on treasuries as low as they are, and I think in general in the bond market, going back to that point that the 60-40 model is broken because the Fed broke bonds and the yield compensating mechanism, I think what's happening is that you're seeing more flow of defensive dollars, of hedging dollars, going into gold and commodities in general, because it has to go somewhere and you can't be all in as a fiduciary in equities for an 80-year-old client, right, as part of your asset allocation. And that probably also explains partially Bitcoin and some of these other moves. The world is hungry for non-correlation, because the biggest, lowest correlation contributor used to be bonds, which aren't there anymore. And the truth is, you only have two assets in this world, risk on and risk off. The very few things that are truly risk off, it really is just risk on.
Excellent. So, Michael, can you explain to us the differences in gold when the inflation scenarios are higher and lower than 3%?
Yes. And this is one of those things where it very much sort of depends on the environment that you're in, right? And I've written about this quite a bit, that gold can act very differently depending upon different inflation rates. The problem with that analysis, which I've been putting out in the lead lag report, is that debt is the thing that's very different compared to prior periods of inflation being above 3% or below, right? It's sort of a guide, a map. So for me, as much as I allude to sort of these relationships, I don't know if any of these relationships will really matter going forward, because again, the starting point of debt is so high that it may break some of these relationships. I do think that if you were to see a period where inflation were sustainably above 3% or more, which the Fed would love to have, but I think good luck. I think all commodities would probably go bonkers. But again, I think it's very hard to get there.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the, let's say, more tightly correlated assets like oil? What do they tell us?
Look, oil is very closely correlated to inflation expectations, right? Because it's something that most people can see every single minute by minute, which gives a sense of cost push inflationary pressures. Oil is obviously a disinflationary force here because it's now competing against solar alternatives, which, and obviously the stay at home and, you know, kind of broader move to not travel as much. All that is disinflationary, deflationary. I've argued before that perhaps the best thing for the Fed here would be to actually have oil prices rise steadily, because that would increase inflation expectations, increase the velocity of money as people expect higher prices due to oil, and then maybe even create a self-fulfilling prophecy of momentum in risk taking because of that. But oil is a troubled sector structurally, very long term. That's not to say that oil is not going to have its moments to shine. I actually think oil looks quite attractive at these kind of levels here, energy sector in general, only because I tend to be contrarian naturally. So I think when everybody says it's the end of a sector, it probably isn't. And these things take time. But, you know, oil is worth paying attention to because of inflation expectations. If you don't see oil pick up here, if you see oil weakening combined with utility strength, treasury strength, lumber weakness, again, I go back to all the stars are aligning that we're in a potential storm right here, right now.
Excellent. So, Michael, you write a lot about the differences between the metals, let's say gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Can you tell us a little bit about the different times when, let's say, one metal looks a little bit better than others?
I mean, the biggest distinction between gold, silver, platinum is that silver and platinum tend to be more industrial than gold, right? Which is, from an industrial perspective, really, it's just jewelry largely. So there's kind of two factors, right? One is the broader commodity metals cycle, where you loop all of them together. Mm-hmm. And then two is a sort of within that cycle, what are the factors that favor industrial versus non-industrial? Silver had done quite well up until several years ago relative to the market because you were having broader industrial activity as the commodity super cycle was there. Then gold kind of pulled away on a pure performance basis, as I think the world started realizing there's so much debt and lack of discipline from the Fed that one way to bet against that is to buy gold. I think there's a broader move that's going to be happening on all three metals and pretty much metals across the board. So I don't think it's just a gold-specific story. I think if you see gold really pull away, that's going to be a really, really fascinating juncture to watch, because if gold really pulls away from other metals, which means it's not about industrial commoditization and activity, it's really about something more serious about the system, that'll be, I think, one of the greatest risk-off tells of all time.
Excellent. That's a great way to put it. So, Michael, one of the final things I'd like to ask you is about dividend yielding stocks in general. So tell us what role they should play in your portfolio. And if you have, let's say, a particular soft spot for gold stocks that have a dividend as well.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's a link between dividends and risk on, risk off, right? So risk on tends to be that which does not have as much dividends and is more growth oriented versus that which is risk off, which is more yield dividend oriented. People really underestimate the role of dividends and in turn the role of compounding in general. I've used this example before. You know, the Dow is not at 28,000 or whatever the level of the Dow industrials is today, because that's an ex-dividend price. If you were to reinvest every single dividend back to the Dow industrials from 1896, you know, the Dow is well north of 2 million as far as the level now. All right. So people underestimate the role of dividends and compounding when you reinvest those dividends. Now, everyone is yield hungry and starved for dividends. The problem is, of course, now we don't really know what dividends are safe, right? Because we're still in a very deep recession. I mean, despite the stock market having done what it's done, we're still in a very deep recession. And again, these things take some time to play out. So I think for those that are looking for some degree of quote unquote safety, you've got to probably go for the staples, the real blue chip, the large companies that have been paying out dividends for decades that are not sexy, not really interesting, just kind of steady, but also recognize that those stocks will probably still lose money. I find a lot of investors are very tempted by seeing a stock or an ETF that's a 10, 15% yield. You got to be real careful with this stuff because these companies are probably going to be cutting dividends across the board. We are not out of this dividend cut cycle yet.
Perfect. So, Michael, as you were mentioning the European financials being in real trouble, are there any other indicators that you're seeing right now that you think that people should start paying a little bit more attention to?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the European financials are the main one. The lumber is another big one. And then again, utilities have been outperforming for 7, 8 weeks straight here. I mean, that's you don't tend to see that in a healthy bull market. You just don't. Again, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a crash, but there is this underpinning of defensiveness that has been happening. Whether it's smart money or whatever the reasoning is, it's occurring. And it's worth paying attention to. Now, how do you take advantage of that? It is really a function of people's risk tolerances. Right? You can simply overweight your overall bonds. You can take on a little cash. I don't ever suggest one should short because shorting has all kinds of dangers associated with it. I think you're much better off just de-risking your beta in general. But again, I keep going back to, you know, the risk is always where you don't see it. And oftentimes, as the saying goes in markets, nothing matters until it matters. But then when it matters, it's the only thing that matters. Nobody seems to care about European financials. Just like, by the way, nobody seemed to care about COVID back in January. And then when it mattered, that was it.
Yeah, that was the only thing that mattered. Excellent, Michael. Well, we can find more of your writing at Lead Lag Report on Twitter and also that website. Is there anywhere else we can find you?
Yeah, no. So as a portfolio, one of the portfolio managers at Truroso Investments of the ATAC Rotation Fund, TurosoInv.com. You know, we do a lot of services for advisors, individual investors. Happy to kind of talk through things that way too.
Excellent. Thanks for your time today, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?